Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
All right, as we get rolling here for the second hour of the show, I actually have my helper in my studio this afternoon. This is another example of how bad of a parent I am. You probably just count, let me count the ways. But on Friday, Dave, you'll love this story too. Maybe I told this to you on Friday. I don't really look at school calendars. And look, we finally got her into actual kindergarten last week. And then I happened to look at a note when I was on the air on Friday that said, hey, we have a teacher development day on Monday, so there's no school. Well, of course, Team Reardon, Mr. and Mrs. Reardon, Alexis, mom and dad, me and Becky, totally unaware that there was no school on Friday or on Monday. Yeah. Massive fail. So my niece was nice enough. She goes to SLU to help out today, but now I have her in here. Would you like to contribute to the show, ma'am, at all? You're going to be quiet? Yeah, she's just going to be quiet. Joe Arnold is back with us this afternoon from Louisville, former WHAS television and radio reporter. How are you, Joe?
Doing well.
Well, I want to talk Cardinals baseball with you, but I thought we'd at least get an update, and this has been overshadowed over the weekend because of the president's diagnosis with COVID, but we did touch base with you last week. You've been doing a great job. Joe has been really awesome here the last month in the aftermath of the Breonna Taylor decision. And then the grand jury tapes were released last week. I've seen some coverage of this, but I wanted to, I guess, first and foremost, find out if anything came out of that that was significant. I've seen a few questions that have been raised, but what's your take? And I don't think there's any way everyone's gone through all those yet, Joe, but what's the, I guess, the feedback right now from those grand jury tapes and what they're indicating?
Well, the biggest take, Mark, is that is this overall dissatisfaction with justice being done for Breonna Taylor because someone's life ended and she should not have died. This is an innocent woman in her home, but as a result of this crossfire between her boyfriend and police, she was tragically killed. So the dissatisfaction results from there's not being really a remedy for that, obviously. And this grand jury that the Attorney General of Kentucky presented the evidence to is there's a disconnect between what their role is and what exactly his purview was. And what's happening now is that because he was strictly looking at the conduct of the officers who were executing the search warrant to be able to go to her home in the first place, rather he did not look at all into how they secured that search warrant. That is a different investigation being done by the federal government and a civil rights investigation at that. But as a result, people are saying this: they did not have the latitude to be able to press charges in this case against these officers, and someone ought to pay. So I think that, to me, is the biggest disconnect. So now you have at least two grand jurors, who are seeking permission to speak publicly about this, presumably to complain that they were not advised well enough by the Attorney General as far as what choices they had as far as pressing charges against those officers.
Yeah, and I think the thing that I saw and all throughout this, and Joe, you and I have had discussions for 2 months now from the point where I finally called you and said, hey, you know, I think we need to know some facts about the Breonna Taylor case, or at least what we could find out. But there is some question, and I'm always open to find out what this investigation is going to reveal, about how the search warrant was obtained and whether or not the officer lied when obtaining that search warrant. There's still some
That's
questions
exactly
even
right.
after seeing the grand. Yeah, right.
Yeah, and even at the announcement of the grand jury's conclusions here, the Attorney General of Kentucky, Daniel Cameron, pointed out that he himself wants to look into and have a task force and ask questions about that because he's not satisfied. But that was not what was advanced. But that was not his purview. That was not his investigation. His was only about the officers who were given that search warrant to say, go execute this. There's a whole other issue as far as how they got that and whether somebody lied about what they witnessed in terms of deliveries to her home by her ex-boyfriend, who was the subject of a drug trafficking investigation and all that kind of thing. One other thing I want to point out, Mark, if I could, as far as what we heard on the tapes that we didn't really quite understand, perhaps, is from the police officers themselves that night. A big question is about whether it is a no-knock warrant, but they did say they knocked. And they said anywhere right. from 90 seconds to 2 minutes, and they describe it from beginning like a pizza delivery knock to begin with, that then escalated to the point of being more of a banging. Only one witness, one neighbor, at any point said that he heard police announce themselves, and later on he changed his story. So that there's a question there. The other thing that I think is most interesting is just the chaos of that night. And as you know, there's one officer who's been charged with the crime of wanton endangerment because of the shots that he fired that went into the neighbor's apartment. That officer believed, he says in his testimony, that he believed his colleagues were getting sprayed by bullets. They were being basically gunned down or executed. Well, what he heard going on then was basically the shots that were being returned by his fellow officers. And so there is this complete fog of war that's being described here in this situation where all the evidence points to the boyfriend of Breonna Taylor firing one shot to begin all of this, and all this other melee that goes on, the police officers returning fire, and then that's what creates this confusion.
And I thought the other thing, and I hadn't had a chance to ask you about this, I thought I saw a clip last week that was released that was a body cam clip from the aftermath of the shooting, which was confusing because I thought there was no body cam video.
There's no body cam video of the officers who were directly involved in the shooting. There was body cam of officers who responded to the shooting. In other words, officer down. They
yes.
show up. They found the officer basically in the parking lot at that point. They lift him up. No ambulance is on the way. He at one point, he says, put me in the trunk. And then they begin to take him to the hospital that way in a police cruiser's trunk. So, again, this was a very chaotic situation. The other thing I think you find out about this, because of the lack of preparation, they went into this thinking this was going to be the cake warrant of the night. This was the easy one. This was the single mom or the single person, single woman mm-hmm. who was home, either her or maybe with a young child. They're just going to go in, do the search warrant, that's going to be it. So they basically, I'm not saying they were ill-prepared, but from what they're describing here, they themselves thought that this was not the most difficult challenge, that the different search warrants were being executed simultaneously at that same midnight hour.
So, Joe, then what happens next? Now you have – I thought – this is another thing that's confusing. I thought that the Attorney General had already said, Daniel Cameron, look, you're free to speak if you want to, but there's a hearing that's going to kind of dial down on to whether or not this is actually going to happen with one juror or maybe more now?
That's correct, because he said in a news release that he would not object to that grand juror speaking, but that still has to go through the courts, formally to grant that permission. So what's happening now is an assistant attorney general has filed a brief saying, well, to make that happen and to make sure we're doing this correctly, we want a hearing on this. They're going to have a hearing on Thursday to discuss, the degree to which or how that actually happens. And, I mean, obviously, I shouldn't say obviously. It seems to me that releasing a grand juror from speaking about a case, that there has to still be some guardrails. For instance, that grand juror presumably would not be allowed to release the identities of the other grand jurors. So there's other things that need to be kept secret. They can't just say you have, broad dispensation to say whatever you want that you found out there, because there are some things that would not be allowed to be public. There are some things that are concerns. And certainly here, the presumption here is that at least one, if not two grand jurors are going to come forward and say, if it were up to me, I would have charged these cops with murder.
Yeah, interesting. All right, Joe, I appreciate all the help on this. We'll probably check back with you later in the week. I'll give you 40 seconds here to wrap up the Cardinals season. Huge fan of the DH. You're hoping that's going to stay, I know, because you're the biggest proponent of that.
What I want to do, because you're right, I love the DH. I think I love all the changes. I think what we need to do, but the one thing is I'm disappointed they didn't bring aluminum bats. And they need to just basically get rid of the pitcher's mound altogether, because to me, tradition is meaningless in baseball. I think you just go with whatever would cause the most havoc.
You know, when I say things like that, I always ask Dave Klein, I'm like, do I need to really clear? Because people think we're serious when we're injecting snark. That is a lot of snark. Joe Arnold, thanks for joining me this afternoon. Good luck down there in Louisville. And I did not manage to capitalize on my Derby trifecta victory with another one for the Preakness. Major fail on Saturday. I went with Mr. Big News again, and he didn't come through for me. So better luck
next
time, Joe. That's right. All right, we'll talk soon. That's Joe Arnold down in Louisville, 3:15. I saw a real interesting story in the Wall Street Journal last week about the state of finances with the American people when it comes to debt and how COVID is reacting to that. And I wanted to talk with Jill Schlesinger from CBS News. She's always great to chat about those things. She's coming up next on KMOX.
Miss any part of the Mark Reardon Show? Download the podcast anytime.
Initiating download. Stand by.
At KMOX.com/Reardon.
Welcome back. 3:20. I saw a piece in the Wall Street Journal a week and a half ago talking about middle class debt. And I think this is a significant issue that is kind of rumbling underneath the surface right now with COVID, people losing jobs. And it started telling a story about Elise Hopkins, who in this story in the Journal said until mid-March, Elise Hopkins earned a comfortable living in Rockland County, New York, representing clients in foreclosure cases and personal injury lawsuits. In a good year, she would make with her husband about $175,000, enough to cover the mortgage, two car leases, student loans, etc. So about $9,000 in monthly debt payments, including mortgage installments, and she lost her job. They can't make the payments now, and this is something that is being repeated throughout the country. And obviously, this issue happens even outside of a pandemic with job losses, recessions. But I think this is something that's scaring people maybe just a little bit more, because you don't know what's going to come out on the other side. And Jill Schlesinger is with me this afternoon, CBS News business correspondent. I thought she'd be great to have a chat about this with. Hey, Jill, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. Good to talk to you.
You know, it's one of those situations, I think everybody sort of has this in the back of their mind, even some of us who have jobs right now. Good Lord, you don't know where this path is heading with COVID. I don't think anyone's really safe outside of some of the businesses that are really spiking, bicycles and golf and stuff like that. But it's a scary situation for a lot of people. And, you know, there's people like those that are highlighted in that story that are already dealing with it. But I have a feeling there's a lot more people down the road that are just on the cusp if something happens.
You know, this really does start to remind me of the housing crisis where, you know, initially in that crisis, you had sort of like these crazy house flippers that were running into big problems, right? And I think that there were a lot of people out there who were a little bit judgmental and said like, hey, you know, you shouldn't have gotten into that crazy business. Too bad you got foreclosed upon. Too bad you're broke. Too bad, too bad. But then there's what we call in economics a second order effect. And that is that maybe as a recession starts to get a little bit longer in the tooth, that there are other businesses that are impacted. And I would just even look at the jobs report where we said, you know, 22 million jobs vaporized in a couple of months, got about a little bit more than half of those back. But we've just recently started getting layoffs, not just from airlines or from theme parks like Disney, but publishing company Houghton Mifflin laid off all of their school book personnel, like something like 23% just lost their jobs. We have insurer Allstate, people not driving as much. They don't need as much auto insurance. Designers, you know, so none of those jobs are in the September report. And yet we know that people are continuing to lose jobs as we get into what almost feels like a normal recession, even though there's a pandemic that's going on. It's not that we're all shut down. It's just that things have slowed down. And a lot of people are at risk, as you say, many of them are middle. And in this case, obviously, if you make 175 grand a year, even if you live in Rockland County, which is outside of New York, you are probably upper middle class, right? But you got a mortgage and you got some car leases and you got some student loans and maybe a couple credit cards out there. And you know what? It's tough. And these people are going to have problems as the pandemic economy continues to unfold.
You know, I think this is going to sound weird, maybe not to you, but throughout this entire 7 months or however deep we're into it right now, the one thing that has shocked me the most is, and maybe it's I'm just not hearing about it, but how people have not been affected more economically. Now, I know they are. Don't misinterpret what I'm saying. But because we've seen the stock market kind of hold steady and because, you know, we've been trying to come up with some sort of normalization, I just feel like it's the I don't know, maybe the forgotten millions of people who are sitting at home. They don't have jobs. They can't find jobs. They can't make their payments. And it's people of all income brackets probably at this point. And it might get worse. That's my concern. And I don't know how the economy can handle that.
Well, I think that there's a couple of things to keep in mind. You know, the Federal Reserve, every time Jerome Powell starts testifying, whether it's before Congress or it's after a Federal Reserve meeting, he keeps talking about those people. He gets very, you know, he sort of like, it looks very earnest and kind of freaked out a little bit if you, you know him a little bit. And he says, you know, right? 10.7 million fewer jobs right now than we had in February. And, you know, what's happening is that we are seeing a disproportionate hit on people who were actually making some progress. So low-wage workers were starting to make progress kind of between 2015 to 2019. They were starting to see more gains. We were seeing people who were of color who were making gains, Black workers, Hispanic workers, they were making gains. All that feels like it's just getting wiped out in the last 7 months. And as you said, there are concerns. I don't want people to think, well, just because you're a white collar worker at home still making a living because your 401k is just fine. Everything's not fine. There are some real problems in the economy. And I think the difference is right now, if we do not get another stimulus, I think that's when the rubber's going to really hit the road in terms of an economic slowdown, because most of the damage that was done early in the crisis, the government kind of rescued us, and as they should. This is what happens when you have an emergency. Businesses stop spending money, consumers stop spending money, government steps in, spends money, right? And that stimulus really did help prop up the economy. But it's clear, as you've noted, we need more, and the dithering is not helping.
No, it's not helping. And, you know, it's bad enough in my part of the country with restaurants and businesses. But I don't even know, how do restaurateurs in New York even survive at all?
Well, you know, I interviewed someone on my podcast, Jill on Money, for those of you wanting to look for wherever you get your favorite podcasts. And he's a restaurant owner in the city. And he said that he believes that something like a third of New York City restaurants are going broke. I mean, that is astounding. The Restaurant Association believes that of the million restaurants that are in the United States, that probably 100,000 are going to fail at least this year. I mean, that's a stunning number. And a lot of these are small businesses. We're not talking about big chains. And I think that what we need to really understand is that there has to be more than a lifeline. You know, it has to be a lifeline for as long as you need your life extended. And, you know, maybe they can't save everyone, but you want to give the industries and the actual businesses that have a chance to survive the ability to survive. And, you know, certainly New York City has looked pretty grim. Some of my favorites have just disappeared. On the other hand, you know, I'm a New Yorker. I'm optimistic. We come back after the 70s debt debacle. We come back in the 80s in the roaring stock market. And after it crashes, we come back after 9/11. And New York City will definitely come back. It's just going to be very different. And there are going to be a lot of people who suffer while we do come back.
And give me just a little bit of a flavor for what it's like, because New York is so vast, and then you have Manhattan in the boroughs, and, you know, we're hearing some of the stories today from, I guess, Mayor Cuomo or Mayor de Blasio and Governor Cuomo about schools. So are schools open in New York City, or it just depends, or how is that going right now?
So schools are open, and it depends like where you are actually zoned as to when your kids go back. Do they go back 2 days a week? Do they go back 5 days a week? My niece happens to be a New York City school teacher in the South Bronx, and she is in the school 5 days a week, but she is actually conducting online classes for two of those 5 days. So many of her, she is a high school teacher. And as a result, when she goes into school, the kids were given a choice. Do you want to come in or do you want to be remote? And most of them, most of the families would rather have the kids home and remote in and be safer. And they're high school kids, so they can pretty much take care of themselves. Although when I was a high school kid, I could get into plenty of trouble. Don't get me wrong.
Me too.
You know, it's going to be the path of the disease that really does dictate what happens. And I will just say that from you know, walking around neighborhoods in New York, because, you know, I'm not getting on public transportation, but just walking around, things are really different, especially Midtown Manhattan, where you don't see people back in their offices right now. That's the place where it's so weird. I walk straight down Broadway into Times Square, and there are no tourists. I mean, that in and of itself, no Broadway, you know, it's really weird. So it just feels so different.
Well, I hope you can get back on track. I want to come back and see my friend Norbert Leo Butz on Broadway and see some other shows and concerts, and hopefully we'll get there. Jill on Money is the podcast. Jill Schlesinger from CBS News. Always great to have you, Jill. Thank you.
Take care. Thanks for having me.
329. By the way, you know, something else is changing quite a bit, and that's how younger people view sports. This is outside of COVID, but the numbers are quite staggering. We'll get into it next on KMOX after we check in with Dr. Garza this afternoon. He's got some St. Louis Regional Pandemic Task Force numbers.
Outside. We also had a great weekend numbers-wise as well from our admissions data. Our hospital admissions data has dropped off back down into the 20s, the same as we saw about a week ago, and so that's good news. We have seen some swings in our numbers within the past week, but hopefully we'll continue to see that trend continue to go down. So Dr. Page today also referenced these numbers, as well as our declining admissions coming from St. Louis City and the county during his press briefing today. And it's because of numbers like this that St. Louis County was able to loosen some of those restrictions that have been in place for the past several months. Those included expanding the number of people allowed inside businesses and high contact sports now being able to compete. Now, these changes wouldn't really be possible without the hard work by the community to limit exposure to COVID. And it's because people adhered to those evidence-based measures, including wearing masks and avoiding large gatherings, that we were able to get to a safe environment and allow those loosenings of restrictions. So this has been a goal from day one in the pandemic, decrease transmission so that we can all get back to as close to normal as we can. So now let's look at today's data, then we'll take a look at some of the latest modeling data, and then we'll see if we have any questions from the media. Okay, so starting off with our admissions data, and again, this is from our Pandemic Task Force hospitals. These are COVID-positive patients only. And as you can see, today we're recording 20 admissions, which is half of where we were last Friday when we reported our data during the briefing. And this brings our 7-day moving average back down to the lower 30s. You can see today we're at 33. It's always good to see that number coming down. And next is our hospital census data. And again, these are confirmed COVID-positive patients only. So today we had 245 COVID patients in our hospitals today, which has again dropped. And our 7-day rolling average is 259, which is down by 9 from Friday. So again, more encouraging news. So let me update you now on some of our daily hospitalization numbers. So again, these are COVID positive patients only. As I mentioned, we had 245 hospitalizations today. We have 71 confirmed COVID positive patients in our intensive care units, which is down slightly from Friday. And we have 49 confirmed COVID patients on our ventilators, which is up by 4. Now, moving on now to our suspected COVID numbers. We have 108 people in the hospital today that either have suspected COVID or were waiting for a test result to come back. We have 20 suspected COVID patients in our intensive care units, and we have 11 suspected COVID patients on ventilators today. Now, moving on to our good news slide. Yesterday, our task force healthcare systems discharged 20 additional COVID patients, bringing our cumulative total to 6,519 patients. And again, a shout out to all of our frontline healthcare workers and the people that support them, able to get our patients healthy and back home to their loved ones.
There you go. That is Dr. Garza this afternoon, giving us some updated numbers and some positive numbers is probably, as he indicated, one of the reasons we saw some loosening of the restrictions by the county executive in St. Louis County earlier today. 333 at KMOX. Well, I mentioned this before the break. I think these are staggering numbers for professional sports leagues when it comes to who's watching and who's not watching, especially younger people. Alex Silverman with me this afternoon to talk about this just a little bit. Hey, Alex, how are you?
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Well, this is an interesting piece when I read it the other day. Look, I'm a huge sports fan. My life is consumed by sports. I never have talked about sports on the radio, never been a play-by-play guy or a sports reporter. That's a different breed. But I love sports. My Sundays are, you know, sort of planned around NFL football. And we have the Cardinals here, of course, in St. Louis. But I do know I have kids, and I've been around younger kids, and they don't have this passion. And that's basically what you guys found out, that this is sort of dangerous area for sports moving into the future with some of these Generation Z figures.
Yeah, exactly. Well, first of all, you're preaching to the choir in terms of, you know, someone who spends their life around sporting events. So, you know, seeing some of the results from our survey was definitely a little bit surprising to me. We found that about 53% of Gen Zers and those folks, those are folks born between 1997 and 2007. They about 53% of them identify as sports fans, which compared to all adults is 10% less, and 69% of millennials identify as sports fans, which is an even higher percentage. They over-index. So you're going from one generation that is overly enthusiastic about sports to a new generation that is less enthusiastic than average.
Now, do we have, like, I have a 20 and 23-year-old, two boys, and they don't have very much interest in sports whatsoever. And I tried to guide them in that direction, but you know what they were doing? They were always playing video games. So do you have a theory, or did the survey detect a theory for why? I mean, obviously, it's not just one thing. There's got to be a combination of things that are leading to this. But do you have a theory?
Yeah, well, I think you're spot on with video games. One thing that our survey found out is that esports, which is the competitive playing of video games, you know, at a sort of professional level, was the fourth most popular sport among Gen Z out of, I think, 27 different leagues and sports that were included in our survey. So, you know, Generation Z respondents were more interested in watching esports than watching Major League Baseball, the National Hockey League, NASCAR, UFC, you know, traditional athletic events, and, you know, the kind of things that sports fans like you and I have, you know, been watching in large numbers for a long time. So I think video games...
Decades, yeah.
Yeah, so I think video games is part of it. And I think one of the things that has attracted people to esports and just from speaking to some people in the industry for the piece is this this sort of the fact that these Generation Z is sort of the generation of the influencer. So they're really attracted rather than being attracted to team brands, they're sort of more attracted to individual personalities. And you have these esports figures who have large online personas, spend a lot of time on the internet streaming themselves playing video games and sort of interacting with their fans. And I think that sort of holds in the sense that the NBA was one of the most popular traditional sports among Generation Z. And, you know, that's sort of a sport that's driven by individual stars. So I think this generation identifies a lot with individual personalities, and you know, the sports that can cater to that are the ones that are going to do well and appeal to the new generation.
Alex Silverman, my guest, senior reporter covering the business of sports from morningconsult.com. You know, it was interesting on that topic of esports. I have to admit that my younger son, my 20-year-old, had a mic drop moment a few years ago because I would walk through my basement and they'd be watching, you know, these tournaments, and they'd be either on the computer or on the television. And I would give him so much trouble about that. And then he said to me, well, because I like to play poker, I'm a Hold'em fan, he said, you watch poker on TV? I'm like, okay. You kind of got me there to a certain extent, and I'll admit that. But, you know, it's frustrating because I love team sports. You know, I with my kids, not that they have to love sports. I mean, it's their life. But I didn't really become, outside of baseball, a big sports fan until I got out of college. So is there anything in the results of the survey that show, because here's the bottom line here, and I guess you got executives all over the country that are in, you know, football, Major League Baseball, even soccer, that would be and should be concerned about the results of this, because how do you interpret this if you're in the business of baseball, football, basketball moving forward? Because obviously you've had tremendous amount of growth in some of those leagues. The NFL, certainly a good example of that. But this is problematic 10 years down the line, 20 years down the line for sure.
Yeah, well, I mean, to your first point, you know, our survey doesn't necessarily account for the fact that maybe these folks are more likely to become sports fans with age. Anecdotally, on a personal level, I was, you know, a huge sports fan as a kid, but I have been, you know, just anecdotally in responses to this piece, I've had some people reach out to me and say, you know, I wasn't a big sports fan until I went to college and, you know, had that experience of, you know, Saturday game days on campus. So, you know, there's
right,
certainly
exactly.
that possibility. However, I think, and also obviously, you know, the people we looked at are ages 13 to 23. So, you know, I feel like there's a big difference between a 13-year-old and a 23-year-old, regardless of generation. But the disparity between, you know, just the gap between millennials and Gen Zers in terms of their sports fandom, you know, I think, you know, regardless of what your theory is on when in life someone, you know, becomes a sports fan, you know, I would think it is something for sports executives, sports marketers, to be concerned about, at least in the sense that they have to think of, you know, how they can innovate, how they can maybe present the game differently. You know, sports has been kind of based on, you know, one of the largest revenue streams in sports are these media rights deals that are tied to the to broadcast television and cable.
Sure.
Cable in particular is on the down. Gen Z, there's a lot of quote unquote cord nevers, people who never subscribed to cable. You know, the NBA in particular, Adam Silver has said, you know, we have so many young fans, but they're not watching our games necessarily because cable isn't really on their radar. And, you know, their big TV deals are with ESPN, a cable network, and Turner, and they have TNT, a cable network. So I think that is, you know, it'll be interesting to see how that evolves. You know, streaming is going to be a big part of this. You're seeing companies, you know, sort of disruptors trying to offer fans the ability to watch, to pay to watch individual games or to sort of pop into a game that's, you know, 5 minutes left in a tie game or something to that effect. So I think you're going to see a lot of attempts to innovate. It's just a question of whether these sports leagues are willing to, in the short term, give up the sure huge rights fee payments that they're getting from these broadcast and cable networks to, you know, experiment and figure out what the long-term monetization model is going to be with this new generation.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. I mean, obviously, you have a fair warning here that you're going to have to innovate. I mean, baseball is a good example, and we're seeing some innovation that was thrust upon the game because of the pandemic, and a lot of people, even like me, and I'm not a big fan of the DH and some of this stuff, but I'd have to admit that looking at what happened with the doubleheaders, we had plenty of those here in St. Louis with putting a man on second base to start the extra innings, probably not a bad innovation because these games drag on so long. So I'm open-minded, but I'm concerned, and I don't know what really turns things around. You know, maybe the other part of this is, I don't. How old are you? Can I ask that?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm 29 years old, so I'm
okay. So
millennial.
You're a lot. But, you know, I'm 55, so when I grew up, there wasn't, you know, you had to focus on sports for the most part, even in the 80s. You know, that was, tennis was huge, golf was huge, so you were drawn to that. Now there's so many different things on social media, sports and otherwise, that it's kind of hard to focus. And if you don't get that, you know, that emotional connection from growing up going to tailgating at Mizzou games or something else, then you may not become the biggest sports fan. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens in the future. But Alex Silverman, senior reporter covering the business of sports at morningconsult.com. I appreciate the interview here this afternoon, and you're welcome back anytime. Thanks, Alex.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And as a Mizzou grad myself, it's great to be on KMOX.
Well, you buried the lead there. How did I not know that? Congratulations. We are fellow. I'm old, though. Bachelor of Journalism, 1986. Man, so many years ago. So many years ago. But congratulations on being part of the Mizzou Mafia. Thanks, Alex.
Thanks a lot. Take care.
He's just a baby, though. He's 29 years old. Stand by. Playback
ready. Now, the audio cut of the day.
Cut of the Day is sponsored by the Good Feet Store Pain Relief and Comfort to fit any budget. The president's physicians gave an update. He's going to get out of the hospital in a short time here from the coronavirus diagnosis. And here's what the physician said earlier today. Sorry about that.
It's been more than 72 hours since his last fever. Oxygen levels, including ambulatory saturations and his work of breathing, are all normal. Though he may not entirely be out of the woods yet, the team and I agree that all our evaluations, and most importantly, his clinical status, support the president's safe return home, where he'll be surrounded by world-class medical care 24/7.
The president continues to do very well. His vital signs this morning were notable for a temperature of 98.1. His blood pressure was 134/78, a respiratory rate of 17 respirations per minute. His heart rate was 68 beats per minute. And his last oxyhemoglobin saturation was 97% on room air.
Yesterday evening, the president received his third dose of remdesivir. He tolerated that infusion without difficulty, and his kidney and liver function continued to be normal. Our plan is to give the fourth dose of remdesivir this evening before he goes back to the White House, and we've made arrangements to deliver the fifth and final dose of his treatment course at the White House tomorrow evening.
Yeah, that's the team at Walter Reed Hospital in Bethesda, White House physician Sean Conley, and other physicians, and the president about to get out of Walter Reed in the next hour. 4 o'clock, Total Information PM is coming up.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
O'Reilly Auto Parts.